Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're jumping into your stack of research on a topic that, honestly, I think a lot of us have filed away for years as just a soft skill.
Right, something that's just nice to have.
Exactly, you know, just being caring. But our sources today, they tell a much, much deeper story.
They really do. The consensus now is that empathy is, it's a highly sophisticated, measurable, and actually teachable human competency. And it's fundamentally neurobiological.
So our mission for this deep dive is to unpack that. We're going to look at its surprising history, explore just how deeply it's hardwired into our brains,
and show you why it is now considered so vital, especially in critical fields like medicine.
When we talk about empathy, what we're really looking at is this intricate mechanism, right? How we bridge the gap between our own experience and someone else's world.
It's the ability to, just for a moment, understand their experience from inside their frame of reference.
Which, I mean, it immediately brings to mind that famous quote that really sets the stage. Yeah. People will never forget how you made them feel.
It's the perfect launch pad. But before we get to the neurons and the brain scans, we have to start with the first huge surprise in the sources, which is the origin story of the word empathy itself.
This is just wild to me. Because if you had told me the word we use for this core human connection wasn't originally about feeling for another person, I just wouldn't have believed it.
It's absolutely true. The English word empathy is a relative newcomer. It was coined around 1908.
Okay.
But it was directly modeled on a much older German concept, Einfühlung.
Einfühlung, which means
literally
in feeling.
In feeling. So what was the context for that?
Well, what's so fascinating here is that the term was first introduced way back in 1858 by Rudolf Lotz, and its roots had absolutely nothing to do with psychology or medicine. It was all about art.
Art. Wait, you mean like appreciating a painting? We invented the word for that?
Exactly. It was rooted entirely in a theory of art appreciation. The core idea was that you appreciate a piece of art based on your ability to project his personality into the viewed object. So you're looking at a statue, and to really get it, you have to project your own feelings into the stone.
That was the idea. You project yourself, your experience into it.
That explains one of the earliest quotes the sources point to. It's from Edward Bradford Titchener in 1909, and it sounds so physical.
It's a wonderful description. He writes, "Not only do I see gravity and modesty and pride, but I feel or act them in the mind's muscles." This is, I suppose, a simple case of empathy.
The mind's muscles. I mean, feeling the gravity of a statue in your own muscles, it really shows how far the meaning has traveled in just over a century, from art critique to, you know, a sign of psychological maturity.
And that journey, well, it required a lot of linguistic elbow room. Which brings us to the nuance of the language itself. Empathy traces back to the Greek empatheia,
which means passion or state of emotion.
Right, from en, meaning in, and pathos, feeling.
And that pathos root is immediately where the trouble starts.
Right.
That's where we get the confusion with its much older cousin, sympathy.
Precisely. Sympathy goes all the way back to the 1580s. From the Greek sympathia, fellow feeling, they share that root, which is why even the experts back then were, you know, debating how to keep the terms clean.
The sources call it the adjective war.
Yeah, this great little academic debate, both empathetic and empathic, pop up around 1909.
But there was a preference.
A strong one. In 1918, a recommendation came out favoring empathic. They were worried that empathetic sounded too much like it might damagingly suggest pathos. They really wanted to draw a line in the sand between the two ideas.
That historical fight for clarity really sets the stage for where we are now, moving from the words to the actual brain.
And this is where the conversation shifts. We stop talking about empathy as just a personality trait or a soft skill and start talking about it as what researchers now call a neurobiologically based competency.
That's a huge reframing.
It is. The science for it comes from this theory of inner imitation. Functional MRI research shows there's a neural relay mechanism at work. When we observe someone, empathic people unconsciously start to mimic their postures, their mannerisms, even their facial expressions.
So if I'm watching you and I kind of tilt my head a bit, my brain is basically running a little simulation to try and figure out what you're feeling.
That's the mechanism. But the most powerful evidence that this is truly hardwired comes back to that old expression, "I feel your pain." The sources detail some incredible research that proves this is way more than just a metaphor.
How on earth did they prove that?
It was a pretty novel study. They took 16 female volunteers, put them in a brain scanner, and gave them mild, painful electric shocks. And this, of course, activated what neuroscientists call the pain matrix.
Let's pause there. The pain matrix.
Mm.
What is that exactly?
Good call. It's a network of regions in the brain, places like the anterior cingulate cortex and the insula, that light up when you process both the physical sensation and the emotional suffering of pain.
Got it. So they scanned him while they felt pain. Then what?
Then came the incredible part. The volunteers would get a signal that their spouse, who was nearby, was about to receive a similar shock. And when that happened, a similar, though not identical, pain matrix lit up in their own brains.
Without being shocked themselves.
Without being shocked themselves, they were literally registering the pain of their loved one in their own brain.
That just completely changes how we think about our connection to each other.
Hmm.
But if we literally feel their pain, I mean, how would we not be emotionally exhausted all the time? How does the brain stop us from just collapsing?
That's the crucial regulatory mechanism. The sources are very clear that the feeling occurs only in an attenuated form.
Attenuated, so like a muted version.
Exactly. Think of it as an echo of the real pain. And this attenuation is vital. It's what prevents you from becoming so overwhelmed by personal distress that you're useless. You can't help. It's the difference between being moved to act and being paralyzed by the feeling.
It makes total evolutionary sense. If it was all just survival of the fittest, you know, pure domination, a system like this shouldn't even exist.
Correct. Instead, our ability to resonate with someone else's suffering is hardwired. It supports mutual aid, which of course is essential for a species to survive. We help each other reduce the collective suffering, and that lets us cooperate in these really complex ways.
So if this is a hardwired competency, let's connect it to the real world. I mean, where does this have the most tangible, measurable benefits? The sources point straight to healthcare.
The value of empathic medical care is just undeniable. We're talking improved patient experiences, people actually sticking to their treatment plans.
Which is huge.
It's huge. And it leads to better clinical outcomes, fewer medical errors, even fewer malpractice claims. It's even linked to higher physician retention.
But, and this is the really troubling part, the sources also highlight this trend that empathy actually declines during medical training.
It does. Study after study shows this erosion, especially during that grueling third year of medical school when they move from books to the clinic.
But why? If it's hardwired, how does it erode? Is it just burnout?
Burnout is a huge factor, but it's also structural. There's this constant pressure to be objective, to distance yourself emotionally. The system is built around find it and fix it, not necessarily stop and listen. That emotional exhaustion leads to what some call empathy fatigue.
And the consequences of that kind of devoid care are massive.
Oh, absolutely. Without some kind of targeted intervention, you get dissatisfied patients who are way less likely to follow treatment plans. That means poorer health outcomes and a complete breakdown of trust.
Which suggests that this thing we used to think of as an inborn trait has to be mutable. I mean, if it can decline, it can also be taught.
That's the key takeaway here. Research now completely challenges that old idea. This vital human competency can be taught. We have studies showing that specific training leads to patient-rated improvements in physicians. It's a dynamic, teachable skill.
That's incredibly optimistic. But the sources also throw up a pretty big red flag, noting that this capacity isn't always an equal opportunity benefactor.
This is where we have to talk about bias. Affective empathy, that gut-level emotional sharing that lights up the pain matrix. It happens most easily among members of our own tribe. People who look like us, sound like us, share our background.
Why are we wired that way?
It's a basic survival mechanism. Our brains are built for incredibly fast threat detection. Perceptions go through the thalamus, the brain's relay station, and hit the amygdala, the threat sensor, in as little as 50 milliseconds.
Wow, that's before you're even consciously aware of what you're seeing.
Exactly. So subconscious biases triggered by difference, racial, ethnic, whatever, can actually override that natural emotional resonance you'd otherwise feel.
So when that emotional empathy is lacking, what do we do?
That's where we need a different system to take over, a more deliberate intellectual one. That's the job of cognitive empathy.
Okay, let's get those two definitions really clear for you, because this distinction is central.
Right. So affective empathy is what we've been talking about. It's emotional resonance, feeling what they feel. Cognitive empathy is different. It's intellectual. It's the ability to accurately understand what another person is thinking or feeling without necessarily taking on the emotion yourself.
So it's perspective taking.
It's perspective taking. It allows you to understand their distress, but keep the distance you need to actually help effectively.
And how do we consciously engage that cognitive empathy to override our biases?
The research shows it's a two-part approach. First, you have to enhance perspective taking, the ability to see it from their point of view. But and this is critical, that has to be coupled with enhancing the value you place on their welfare.
Wait, so it's not just about trying to imagine yourself in their shoes. It's about making a conscious, almost moral choice to value their well-being first.
It is a deliberate action. Intentionally valuing the welfare of someone who is different from you is this powerful and often overlooked precursor to feeling empathy for them. It's a choice that directly increases helping behaviors.
Before we get to the practical steps, we have to finalize the terminology. Let's draw those sharp lines between empathy, sympathy, and pity.
This is so important. We can use the framework from psychiatrists like Salita and Wilmer. It's all about the professional relationship and emotional distance.
Okay, so first up, pity.
Pity separates you from the other person. It's often condescending. It can even hide feelings of contempt. It's a feeling of superiority towards someone who is suffering.
And there's sympathy.
Sympathy is shared suffering, suffering with them as if the pain belonged to both persons. Now, while it's well-intentioned, this is incredibly burdensome and leads straight to burnout. You dissolve the professional boundary and become unable to help.
And that leaves empathy.
Empathy. The sources call it the feeling relationship of engaged detachment.
Engaged detachment, I like that.
It means the physician understands the patient's situation as if they were the patient. But, crucially, they maintain that professional distance. You're borrowing the feelings to understand, not taking them on as your own. It's cognitive and affective working together.
That feels like the key to making this sustainable. Which leads us right into the practical side. How do you take this concept and make it efficient and actionable in, say, a busy clinic?
It comes down to structured communication. The sources detail 6 key steps from a researcher named Frederick Platt that translate this insight into action.
Okay, what's step one?
Step one, you have to recognize that there's a strong feeling present, fear, anger, whatever. Step two, you pause. You actually take a second to imagine their feeling, engaging that cognitive empathy. Step three, you state your perception. You say something like, it sounds like you're really frustrated.
You're basically forming a hypothesis about their internal state. What are the last three?
Step four is to legitimize the feeling, validate their experience. 5 is to respect their coping effort, acknowledge their trying. And finally, step 6 is to offer support and partnership. Use language like, I'm committed to working with you on this. That sequence makes the patient feel heard before you even try to solve the problem.
But the data shows clinicians miss these chances all the time. They're called empathy opportunities or clues.
It's a huge gap. One study showed physicians responded in only 38% of surgical cases. In primary care, it was just 21%.
Wow.
And when you miss those clues, the patient just repeats them, which leads to longer, more frustrating appointments and doctor shopping. The lack of empathy actually ends up costing more time.
Let's break that efficiency point down with that hypothesis test feedback loop example from the sources.
Okay, so the patient says, I am sick and tired of these headaches. No one can help me. They sound frustrated.
So the doctor makes an empathic hypothesis. I can see you're frustrated by the lack of improvement.
And the patient gives immediate feedback. They say, yeah, but I'm really more worried we're missing something serious. I've got a family depending on me. So the doctor was wrong about the emotion. It wasn't frustration. It was fear. But the attempt made the patient feel safe enough to clarify.
And that lets the doctor correct the hypothesis instantly. So it sounds like you're really more concerned that something serious is going on.
And the patient closes the loop. Yes, exactly. Boom. The real issue is on the table. The patient feels validated. And the doctor now knows the true concern. That whole exchange saves minutes. It's the definition of efficiency.
So if it's so efficient, why do we hear the same barriers over and over? I don't have time. It's too emotionally exhausting. I don't want to open that Pandora's box.
They're understandable fears, but they're misconceptions. We have to keep reiterating. Empathy facilitates the interview. It increases efficiency. Opening that Pandora's box almost always leads to clarity, not chaos.
Which brings us to the final and maybe most neglected piece of this puzzle, self-empathy.
Absolutely. You can't pour from an empty cup. Self-empathy is essential for replenishment. When caregivers are emotionally overloaded, overwhelmed, or burned out, their capacity for empathy just plummets. Self-care is a critical step to maintain high-quality empathic care.
What a journey this has been. I mean, we started with empathy as this niche term for an art critic talking about a statue.
Traced its Greek roots and then found these profound hardwired circuits in our brain that let us literally feel an echo of someone else's pain.
We validated it's essential not just for professional success, but for our very survival as a species.
And we learned it's this complex thing requiring our cognitive, emotional, behavioral, and even moral capacities to work together. And that real compassion, well, it can't exist without it.
And for you, I think the most important finding is that the path to being more empathic, especially across our differences, doesn't always start with a spontaneous burst of emotion. It can start with a choice.
Precisely. The sources show you can enhance empathic concern by making a conscious decision to value the welfare of people who seem different from you. So if valuing the welfare of an unfamiliar person is that powerful, overlooked first step, here's a final provocative thought for you to consider.
What single intentional step can you take today to extend that value to someone outside your immediate community? Recognizing that empathy so often begins not with a feeling, but with a deliberate moral choice.